Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you very much and good morning. In 1987, the late Dr. Alan Bloom, a professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago, wrote a book which angered many professional educators. His book has the title, The Closing of the American Mind: How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and Impoverished the Souls of Today's Students. Even though Dr. Bloom's book is large, almost 400 pages, and difficult reading, it became a bestseller. A few excerpts from Dr. Bloom's book will give you some insight into why America's educational establishment was upset. There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative. If this belief is put to the test, one can count on the student's reaction. They will be uncomprehending. That anyone should regard the proposition as not self-evident astonishes them, as though he were calling into question 2 plus 2 equals 4. Page 25. The word relative means there are no absolutes. The students, of course, says Dr. Bloom, cannot defend their opinion. It is something with which they have been indoctrinated. Page 26. There is no enemy other than the man who is not open to everything. Page 27. There are no absolutes. Freedom is absolute. Page 28. To deny the possibility of knowing good and bad is to suppress true openness. Openness, as currently conceived, is a way of making surrender to whatever is most powerful, or worship of vulgar success, look principled. Pages 40 and 41. You do not have to be an educator to understand how Dr. Bloom's book angered America's educators, especially those who teach in or administer our colleges and universities. Dr. Thomas Sowell has also written critically of our educational system in America. But educators are reluctant to criticize Dr. Sowell because he is black. Educators are primarily upset with white men, except Associate Justice Thomas of the United States Supreme Court. Many of them despise Justice Thomas because he is a conservative black. Some of his fellow blacks have accused him of not thinking like a black. How absolutely insulting and intolerant. Dr. Ronald Nash, a prominent American theologian and philosopher, wrote a book in 1990 with the title, The Closing of the American Heart: What's Really Wrong with America's Schools. Dr. Nash provides some legitimate criticisms of Dr. Bloom's book. He has an excellent discussion of the moral and intellectual problems facing America. It would not be easy to find a more perceptive critique of American society in general, and of our educational establishment in particular, than this book by Ronald Nash. A group of prominent theologians and philosophers published the book, Opening the American Mind: The Integration of Biblical Truth in the Curriculum of the University. This book was edited by David Beck and includes chapters by some of America's best-known conservative theologians and educators. The men who wrote the book have excellent suggestions about integrating the Bible into every academic discipline, including the social sciences and the biological sciences. The purpose of the book is to set forth a model for accomplishing the reopening of the American mind to absolute truth, absolute values, and the Bible as God's revelation. Page 8. Our lesson today has two main emphases: the opening of the American conscience and the closing of the American conscience. It is imperative that we understand the conscience and its functions. Many religious and non-religious people appeal to the conscience as their guide. Who has not heard someone say, "Let your conscience be your guide"? My friends, the human conscience is not a guide. Its function is to tell you if you are living in harmony with your beliefs. If you violate those beliefs, your conscience will smite you. If you live in harmony with your beliefs, your conscience will allow you to sleep at night. It will not condemn you. The human conscience is God-ordained and will help us if we listen to its voice, a very silent but a very powerful voice. Christians must not live in such a way as to violate their consciences. Paul does not use the word conscience in the following passage, but there can hardly be any doubt that what he says applies to the conscience. It is good neither to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, nor anything whereby your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. Do you have faith? That is faith in the action you are taking. Have it to yourself before God. Happy is the man who condemns not himself in that thing which he allows. And he who doubts is damned if he eats, because he does not eat of faith. For whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Romans 14:21-23. How can anyone deliberately violate his convictions and not suffer the consequences? Have you ever talked with anyone about his or her immoral conduct and have that person to say, "I see nothing wrong with what I have done"? We must realize that many men and women can commit the most grievous sins and feel no guilt for their conduct. The reason in many cases is very simple. Their consciences have been violated so much, they no longer have any sensitivity to wrongdoing. That is really a sad state of affairs, but one which is quite common, even among those who claim to be Christians. If we keep on living contrary to our beliefs, the conscience will cease to function. In his great letter to the Romans, Paul discusses the function of the conscience in relationship to our behavior. For when the Gentiles, who have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. Romans 2:14-16. Some of the words in this passage demand careful scrutiny. The expression by nature, phusei, can mean either our inherited attributes and behavior or that which comes from habitual conduct. I doubt that Paul was speaking of inherited qualities, but what the Gentiles had learned from their parents and from society in general. Does man inherit a knowledge of right and wrong, or merely the potential for determining right and wrong? The thoughts of which Paul speaks were the reasonings or the imaginations of the Gentiles. Their thoughts were either accusing or excusing. The word accusing means that the Gentiles were behaving contrary to what they believed. Their consciences told them, "You are a hypocrite. You're not living by what you profess to believe." If one lives contrary to his convictions, his thoughts accuse or object to such behavior. On the other hand, if he is consistent with what he professes, his conscience will excuse his behavior. The word excuse literally means to give a reason for one's beliefs or conduct. Can you not see from this brief examination of Romans 2 just how vital the human conscience is? Let me raise one very vital question. If men are descended from the animals, who apparently have no consciences, where did our consciences originate? Sometimes animals kill and eat their own offspring. They do so without any compunction of conscience. Why cannot human beings do the same? The truth is, God implanted the conscience in every human being. We may not pay any attention to it, but it is there and functions until we violate it so much that it no longer has any place in our lives. We also need to remember that the conscience may tell us what we have done is right when we have committed grievous sins. The conscience can only function according to our education and training. If men and women have been taught that abortion is right, or at least permissible, when they abort their babies, many of them do not have any guilty consciences. On the other hand, if they have been taught that all human life is sacred, their consciences can destroy them. The word conscience does not appear in the Old Testament, at least not in the King James Version. It is used 32 times in the New Testament. I can give you just a few examples. John 8 tells of the adulterous woman whom the Jews brought to Jesus. The men who brought the woman were upset by our Lord's actions. They did not know that he understood their motivations. When he stooped to write on the ground a second time, the men who brought the woman were convicted by their own consciences and left Jesus and the woman standing alone. John 8, 8 and 9. The consciences of these hypocrites drove them away from the presence of the spotless Son of God. The Apostle Paul, while he was still called Saul of Tarsus, had done all within his power to persecute and to destroy the church of the living God. When he was converted to Christ, he was called on the carpet by the Jewish council. The council members believed that Paul was a traitor to the religion of his fathers. When he was given an opportunity to defend himself, he explained, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." Acts 23:1. Did Paul mean that he had done right in God's eyes? Absolutely not. It means that he was honest in opposing Jesus Christ and his church. Do you understand why the conscience is not and cannot be a guide? Acts 24 tells of Paul's appearance before Felix. Paul had been accused of crimes against the Jewish nation and was defending his actions before various groups. He said to Felix, "And herein do I exercise myself, to have always a good conscience void of offense toward God and toward men." Acts 24:16. Paul had been wrong in his opposition to Christ and to his church, but he had not intended to be wrong. When he obeyed the gospel, he continued to be concerned about not violating his convictions. He could not behave in an offensive way, either toward God or toward other men. Would to God that every Christian would imitate Paul's example. Eating meat sacrificed to idols was a source of conflict and confusion at Corinth. Many, if not most, of the Corinthian Christians had come from a background of idolatry. They had difficulties deciding if it were permissible to eat meat which had been sacrificed to idols. Paul assures them that an idol is nothing, that there is only one God. He then explains, "Howbeit, there is not in every man that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. For if any man see you, who has knowledge, sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? But when you sin against the brethren and wound their weak consciences, you sin against Christ." 1 Corinthians 8:7, 10, and 12. There is much in these verses from 1 Corinthians 8 which deserves our careful attention, but I cannot examine them today. Of this we can be sure: we must not violate our consciences, and we must make every effort not to lead others to violate their consciences. We should be able to understand Paul's reason for teaching that truth. There is one other very important passage which relates to the conscience. "The like figure whereunto even baptism does also now save us, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ." 1 Peter 3:21. When a person comes to understand his guilt for rebellion against God, he needs to have his conscience cleansed. For the alien sinner to be saved and to get rid of his sin, he must believe the gospel, repent of his sins, confess his faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and be baptized for the remission of sins. This is God's plan for purifying the conscience. If all human beings are born with consciences, why do not all people feel guilt for the same misconduct? In other words, some people seem to be able to steal, to lie, to commit adultery, and even to murder without showing any signs of a guilty conscience. Others are eaten alive for the same behavior. Why the difference? Our consciences are placed in us by the God who made us. But we must be taught right and wrong for our consciences to function. Our consciences function in harmony with our convictions. If we have been taught all our lives, as I have, and as most of you have, that missing church services deliberately is sinful, then our consciences will smite us. If we have been taught that it is not wrong to steal or to cheat on our wives, then our consciences will allow us to sleep like babies. If we continually act contrary to our beliefs, then our consciences will become seared as with a hot iron. I knew a young man in Georgia who divorced his wife after a very short marriage. When the divorce was final, his wife's sister said to the husband, "I will live with you." So he started living in adultery with her. I asked him, "Does your conscience ever bother you?" He replied, "My what?" I explained what I meant. He assured me that he had no guilt feelings. He apparently had not been taught about the sinfulness of adultery. Or if he were taught, he did not learn the lesson. Is it possible that millions of Americans have not been taught the difference between right and wrong? Our consciences are opened when we are taught at home, at church services, and elsewhere, the difference between right and wrong. A number of outstanding books have been published in the last several years, which ought to be helpful to parents who want to teach their children about right and wrong, good and evil. Dr. William Kirk Kilpatrick published the book, Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. Dr. William Bennett also wrote a book which deals with moral values by which we all ought to live. His book has the title, The Devaluing of America, The Fight for Our Culture and Our Children. If we fail to teach our children, they may engage in the most heinous deeds without any compunction of conscience. Would a failure to teach our children explain the tragedies in Pearl, Mississippi, Paducah, Kentucky, and Littleton, Colorado? The closing of the American conscience did not begin in the last 5 or 10 years. It has been going on for many decades. In 1973, Dr. Carl Menninger of the famous Menninger Clinic asked in his best-selling book, Whatever Happened to Sin? Please listen to this distinguished psychiatrist. In all the laments and reproaches made by seers and prophets, one misses any mention of sin, a word which used to be a veritable watchword of prophets. It was a word once in everybody's mind, but rarely is heard in our day. Does that mean that no sin is involved in all our troubles, sin with an I in the middle? Is no one any longer guilty of anything? Guilty of a sin that could be repented and repaired or atoned for? Is it only that someone may be stupid or sick or criminal or asleep? Wrong things are done, we know. Tares are being sown in the wheat field at night. But is no one responsible, nor anyone answerable for these acts? Anxiety and depression we all acknowledge, and even vague feelings. But has no one committed any sins? Where indeed did sin go? What became of it? Page 13. Dr. Menninger defines what he means by sin. I have in mind behavior that violates the moral code or the individual conscience or both. Behavior which pains or harms or destroys my neighbor or me, myself. You know, and Time Magazine knows, what wrongdoing is, and if a better word is available, use it. Page 17. From a biblical viewpoint, Dr. Menninger's definition of sin is inadequate, but it is at least a start in the right direction. He adds the following clarifications. Sin is the transgression of the law of God, disobedience of the divine will, moral failure. Sin is failure to realize in conduct and character the moral ideal, at least as fully as possible under existing circumstances. Failure to do as one ought toward one's fellow man. Pages 18 and 19. It is not at all unusual for psychiatrists and psychologists to wonder what churches are doing about sin. Dr. O. Hobart Maurer of the University of Illinois has expressed his concern about the dereliction of duty on the part of many modern churches. Unfortunately, it does not require a great amount of effort to ascertain what is occurring in many modern churches. Dr. Robert Schuller of the famous Crystal Cathedral in California objects to anyone using the word sin. He thinks that concept is entirely too negative. Has he ever read what Jesus and his apostles taught about sin? Paul warned the Ephesians, "But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as become saints, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." Ephesians 5, 3 through 5. Would Dr. Schuller preach these great truths in his famous cathedral? If he would not, can he honestly say he is preaching the whole counsel of God? In 1991, James Patterson and Peter Kim published a very disturbing book with the title, "The Day America Told the Truth: What People Really Believe About Everything That Really Matters." Their book reports on a survey which was conducted throughout the United States. Please listen and weep for the American people. 77% of Americans say they do not see the point of observing the Sabbath. 74% say they will steal from those who won't miss it. 64% will lie when it suits them, so long as it does not cause real damage. And who decides when lying will do real damage to oneself or to others? 56% of Americans will drink and drive if they feel like they can handle it. They claim to know their limit. 53% will cheat on their spouses. After all, given the chance, he or she will do the same. 50% will procrastinate at work and do absolutely nothing about one full day in every five. It is standard operating procedure. 41% will use recreational drugs. 30% will cheat on their taxes, up to a point. 31% will put their lovers at risk for a disease. I sleep around a bed, but who doesn't? Technically, I may have committed date rape, but I know that she wanted it as much as I did. 20% of young women have been date raped. Patterson and Kim provide some very valuable insights into why there has been a closing of the American conscience. Only 50% of 18 to 24 year olds honestly feel that they've gotten a strong moral foundation, versus 61% of adults aged 25 to 60 versus 78% aged 65 or older, ages 25 and 26 and 62. Our parents and churches failing to give a strong moral foundation for our young people. If they are, what excuse can they offer for their failure? Patterson and Kim asked the American people, "What are you willing to do for $10 million? For $2 million? For $10 million, one in four of us would abandon our friends and abandon our church. About as many would turn to prostitution for a week. Some of us would go much further, as far as murder, changing race, or changing our sex. In fact, 7% of us say that we would murder someone for money. That is about 1 in 14 people. Whether they could actually pull the trigger is another question. But 36 million of us would be willing to consider the offer." Patterson and Kim say that today, the majority of Americans, 62%, think there's nothing morally wrong with the affairs they are having. Pages 19 and 95. There is much more information we all need on the topic I'm discussing with you. But I want to close our discussion with a question. How do we arouse the consciences of our fellow Americans? Time will permit just a few suggestions. The home, dear friends, is absolutely indispensable in the changing of the American moral landscape. If parents do not teach, both by precept and by example, children are not likely to learn what God expects of them and what a decent society expects. That is the reason the Bible, from beginning to end, stresses the responsibility of parents to teach. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22:6. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6:4. Parents must also set an example of honor, decency, and godliness. Can churches arouse the American conscience by being silent on the grave moral issues we face in our nation? Do we believe what the Bible teaches on morality? And are we willing to risk being unpopular among our brethren and in the world by speaking out against beverage alcohol, gambling, abortion, infanticide, physician-assisted suicide, manipulation of human genes to make people better? Churches which fail to speak out will be held accountable in the day of judgment. We must realize that silence can be sinful. May God help us to be His faithful representatives among men. Thank you for listening, and may God richly bless you.